and sick of fighting, and I know Arthur is so too. He has brought peace in these isles, from Cornwall to Lothian. I don't like to think that this great king, this great man, is my enemy, and that for the sake of Avalon I must bring him down to nothing, to death or dishonour. I would rather love him, as all men do. I would like to look on my mother, not you, mother, but Lady Morgaine. I would like to look on her who bore me as my mother, not as the great priestess who I am sworn to obey whatever she bids me. I would that she were my mother, not the goddess. I wish that when Ninian lay in my arms, she were no more than my own dear love, whom I love because she has your sweet face and your lovely voice. I'm so weary of gods and goddesses. I would that I'd been your son and Lot's, and no more than this. I am so weary of my fate. And he lay for a long moment, quiet, his face hidden, his shoulders shaking. Tentatively, Morgause stroked his hair. At last he raised his head and said, with a bitter grin that defied her to make anything of his moment of weakness, "I will now have another cup of that strong spirit they brew in these hills, without the water and honey this time." And when it was brought, he drained it, without even looking on the steaming porridge and bannock the girl had brought. "What was it said in those old books of Lot's when the house priest beat Gareth and me until our backsides were bloody trying to teach us the Roman tongue? Who was yonder old Roman who said, 'Call no man happy until he is dead'? My task, then, is to bring that greatest of all happinesses to my father. And why should I then rebel against that fate?" He signalled for another drink. When Morgause hesitated, he seized the flask and poured the cup full again. "You will be drunk, my dear son. Eat your supper first, will you not?" "So I will be drunk," said Gwydion bitterly. "So let it be. I drink to death and to dishonour, Arthur's and mine." Again he drained the drinking horn and flung it into a corner where it struck with a metallic sound. "So let it be as the fates have ordained. A king stag shall rule in the forest until the day the lady has ordained. For all the beasts were born and joined with others of their kind and lived and worked, the will of the forces of life, and at last gave up their spirits into the keeping of the lady again." He spoke the words with a strange, harsh emphasis, and Morgause, untrained in druid lore, knew that the words were those of ritual, and shivered as he spoke them. He drew a deep breath, then he said, "But for tonight I shall sleep in my mother's house, and forget Avalon and kings and stags and fates. Shall I not? Shall I not?" And, as the strong drink at last overpowered him, he fell forward into her arms. She held him there, stroking his fine dark hair, so much like Morgaine's own, as he slept with his head on her breast. But even in his dreams he twitched and moaned and muttered, as if his dreams were evil. And Morgause knew it wasn't only the pain of his unhealed wound.
The End. You've been listening to The King Stag, Book 3 of The Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. The Mists of Avalon concludes with Book 4, The Prisoner in the Oak, also narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order The Prisoner in the Oak, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Prisoner in the Oak, Book 4 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. This work, copyrighted 1982 by Marion Zimmer Bradley, is recorded by arrangement with the Scott Meredith Literary Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. As the King Stag came to a close, peace reigned in all the kingdom, from Cornwall to Lothian. In the far north, Gwydion returned to Morgawse's castle from fighting in Brittany with Arthur's army. Gwydion, torn between obedience to Morgaine as her son and a priest of Avalon, and his desire to one day take his father's place upon the throne of Camelot, savagely toasted his despair. "So I will be drunk, so let it be. I drink to death and dishonor, Arthur's and mine." And now, Book 4 of The Mists of Avalon, The Prisoner in the Oak.
Chapter 1. In the far hills of North Wales, rain had been falling day after day, and the castle of King Urien seemed to swim in fog and damp. The roads were ankle-deep mud, the fords swollen as rivers rushed down in spate from the mountains, and damp chill gripped the countryside. Morgaine, wrapped in cloak and heavy shawl, felt her fingers stiffening and slowing on the shuttle as she sent it through the loom. Suddenly she started upright, the shuttle falling from her cold hands. "What is it, mother?" Maylene asked, blinking at the sharp sound in the quiet hall. "There is a rider on the road," Morgaine said. "We must make ready to welcome him." And then, observing her daughter-in-law's troubled look, she cursed herself. Again she had let herself slip into the half-trance which women's work always brought upon her nowadays. She had long ago ceased to spin, but weaving, which she enjoyed, had seemed safe if she kept her wits about her and didn't succumb to the drowsy, trance-like monotony of it. And Maylene was looking at her in the half-wary, half-exasperated way which Morgaine's unexpected seeings always evoked. Not that Maylene believed there was anything wicked or even magical about them. It was just her mother-in-law's queer way. But Maylene would speak of them to the priest, and he would come again and try to be subtle, about asking her whence they came, and she would have to put on a meek woman face and pretend she didn't know what he was talking about. Some day she would be too weary or too unguarded to care, and she would speak her mind to the priest. Then he would really have something to talk about. Well, done was done, and couldn't be helped now. She got along well enough with Father Ian, who had been Uwain's tutor. He was an educated man for a priest. "Tell the father that his pupil will be here at dinner-time," Morgaine said, and once again realized that her tongue had slipped. She had known Maylene had been thinking of the priest, and had responded to Maylene's thoughts, not her words. She went out of the room, leaving the younger woman staring. All the winter, which had been heavy with rain and snow and repeated storms, not a single traveller had come. She dared not spin. It opened the gates too quickly to trance. Now weaving was likely to do the same. She sewed industriously at making clothes for all the folk of the household, from Urien's down to Maylene's newest baby. But it was hard on her eyes to do fine needlework. In the winter she had no access to fresh herbs and plants, and could do little with brewing simples and medicines. She had no companion. Her waiting women were the wives of Urien's men-at-arms, and duller than Maylene. Not one of them could spell out so much as a verse in the Bible, and were shocked that Morgaine could read and write and knew some Latin and Greek. And she couldn't sit always at her harp. So she had spent the winter in a frenzy of boredom and impatience. The worse, she thought, because the temptation was always there to sit and spin and dream, letting her mind slide away to follow Arthur at Camelot or Accolon on quest. It had come to her 3 years ago that Accolon should spend enough time at court that Arthur should know him well and trust him. Accolon bore the serpents of Avalon, and that might prove a valuable bond with Arthur. She missed Accolon like a constant ache. In his presence, she was what he always saw her, high priestess, confident of her goals and herself. But that was secret between them. In the long, lonely seasons, Morgaine experienced recurrent doubts and dreads. Was she then no more than Urien's thought her, a solitary queen growing old, body and mind and soul drying and withering? Still, she kept her hand firmly on this household, over country folk and castle folk alike, so that all should turn to her for counsel and wisdom. They said in the country around, "The queen is wise. Even the king does nothing without her consent." The tribesmen and the old ones, she knew, came near to worshipping her, though she dared not appear too often at the ancient worship. Now, in the kitchen house, she made arrangements for a festal dinner, or as near to it as they could come at the end of a long winter when the roads were closed. Morgaine gave from the locked cupboard some of her hoarded store of raisins and dried fruits, and a few spices for cooking the last of the bacon. Maeline would tell Father Ian that Uwain was expected at the hall for dinner. She herself should bear the tidings to Urien's. She went up to his chamber, where he was lazily playing at dice with one of his men-at-arms. The room smelled frousty and unaired, stale and old. "At least his long siege with the lung fever this winter has meant I need not be expected to share his bed." "It has been just as well," Morgaine thought dispassionately, "that Accolon has spent this winter in Camelot with Arthur. We might have taken dangerous chances and been discovered." Urien set down the dice cup and looked up at her. He was thinner, wasted by his long struggle with the fever. There had been a few days when Morgaine thought he couldn't live, and she had fought hard for his life, partly because in spite of everything she was fond of him and didn't want to see him die, partly because Avaloch would have succeeded to his throne the moment he died. "I have not seen you all day. I've been lonely, Morgaine," Urien said, with a fretful note of reproach. "Hugh here is not half so good to look at." "Why?" Morgaine said, tuning her voice to the broad jesting Urien's liked. "I have left you purposely alone, thinking that in your old age you had taken a taste for handsome young men. If you do not want him, husband, does that mean that I can have him?" Urien's chuckled. "You are making the poor man blush," he said, smiling with broad good nature. "But if you leave me alone all day, why, what am I to do but moon and make sheep's eyes at him, or at the dog?" "Well, I've come to give you good news. You shall be carried down to the hall for dinner tonight. Uwain is riding hither, and will be here before supper time." "Now God be thanked," Urien said. "I thought this winter that I should die without seeing either of my sons again." "I suppose Accolon will return for the midsummer festivals." In her body, Morgaine felt a stab of hunger so great that it was pain, as she thought of the Beltane fires, now only 2 months away. "Father Ian has been at me again to forbid the rites," Urien said peevishly. "I am tired of hearing his complaints. He has it in mind that if we cut down the grove, then the folk would be content with his blessing of the fields and not turn away to the Beltane fires. It is true that there seems more and more of the old worship every year. I had thought that as the old folk died off year by year, it would grow ever less. I was willing to let it die out with the old people who could not accustom themselves to new ways. But if the young people now are turning back to heathen ways, then we must do something. Perhaps even cut down the grove."
"If you do, I shall do murder," Morgaine thought.
but schooled her voice to gentleness and reason. That would be wrong. The oaks give pig food and food for the country people. Even here we have had to use acorn flour in a bad season. And the grove has been there for hundreds of years. The trees are sacred.
You sound too much a pagan yourself, Morgaine.
Can you say the oak grove is not the work of God? She retorted. Why should we punish the harmless trees because foolish men make a use of them that Father Ian doesn't like? I thought you loved your land.
Well, and so I do, said Uriens fretfully. But Avaloch, too, says I should cut it down, so that the pagan should have no place of resort. We might build a church or chapel there.
But the old ones are your subjects, too, Morgaine said. And in your youth you made the great marriage with the land. Would you deprive the old people of the grove that is their food and shelter, and their own chapel built by the very hands of God and not of man? Would you then condemn them to die, or starve, as they have done in some of the cleared lands? Uriens looked down at his gnarled old wrists. The blue tattoos there had almost faded, and were no more than pale stains.
Well, are you called Morgaine of the Fairies? The old people could have no better advocate. Since you plead for their shelter, my lady, I will spare the grove while I live. But after me, Avaloch must do as he will. Will you fetch me my shoes and robe, so that I may dine in hall like a king, and not an old dodderer in bedgown and slippers?
Do be sure, said Morgaine, but I cannot lift you now. Hugh will have to dress you. But when the man had finished his work, she combed Urien's hair and summoned the other man-at-arms who awaited the king's call. The two men lifted him, making a chair between their arms, and carried him into the hall where Morgaine placed cushions about his high seat, and watched as the thin old body was deposited there. By that time she could hear servants bustling about, and riders in the courtyard. Owain, she thought, hardly raising her eyes as the young man was escorted into the hall. It was hard to bear in mind that this tall young knight with broad shoulders and a battle scar along one cheek was the scrawny little boy who had come to her, like a wild animal tamed, in her first lonely, desperate year at Urien's court. Owain kissed his father's hand, then bent before Morgaine.
My father, dear mother. It's good to see you home again, lad, said Uriens.
But Morgaine's eyes were on the other man who followed him into the hall. For a moment she didn't believe it. It was like seeing a ghost. Surely, if he were really here, I would have seen him with the sight. And then she understood. I have been trying so hard not to think of Accolon, lest I go mad. Accolon was slenderer than his brother, and not quite so tall. His eyes darted to Morgaine, one swift, furtive look as he knelt before his father. But his voice was wholly correct when he turned to her.
It is good to be home again, lady.
It's good to have you here, she said steadily. Both of you. Owain, tell us how you got that dreadful scar on your cheek. Since the defeat of Emperor Lucius, I thought all men had pledged to Arthur to make no further trouble.
The usual, said Owain lightly. Some bandit who moved into a deserted fort and amused himself by preying on the countryside and calling himself a king. Lot's son, Gawain, went with me, and we made short work of him, and Gawain got himself a wife out of it. The lady is a widow with rich lands. As for this,
he touched the scar lightly.
While Gawain fought the master, I took the man, an ugly bastard who fought left-handed and got through my guard. Clumsy, too. I'd rather fight a good swordsman than a bad any day. If you'd been there, mother, I wouldn't have quite such a scar. The surgeon who stitched it up for me had hands like cabbages. Has it spoilt my looks as much as that?
Morgaine reached out and gently touched her stepson's slashed cheek.
You will always be handsome to me, my son. But perhaps I can still do something. There is festering there, and swelling. Before I sleep, I will make you a poultice for it, so that it will heal better. It must pain you.
It does,
Uwain admitted. But I thought myself lucky not to get the lockjaw from it, which one of my men did.
Ay, what a death.
He shuddered.
When the wound swelled, I thought I was for it too. And my good friend Gawain said, as long as I could drink wine, I was in no danger. And he kept me well supplied too. I swear I was drunk for a fortnight, mother.
He guffawed.
I would have given all the plunder of that bandit's castle for some of your soup. I couldn't chew bread or dried meat, and I nearly starved to death. I did lose 3 teeth.
She rose and peered at the wound. Open your mouth.
Yes, she said, and gestured to one of the servants. Bring Sir Uwain some stew and some stewed fruit, too, she said. You mustn't even try to chew hard food for a while. After supper, I'll see to it.
I won't say no to that, mother. It still hurts like the devil. And besides, there's a girl at Arthur's court. I don't want her to shrink away as if I were a devil face.
He chuckled.
But for all the pain in his wound, he ate hugely, telling tales of the court until they were all laughing. Morgaine dared not take her eyes from her stepson. But all through the meal she could feel Accolon's eyes on her, warming her as if she were standing in sunlight after the winter's chill. It was a merry meal, but at last Uriens began to look weary, and Morgaine summoned his body servants.
"This is the first day you have left your bed, my husband. You mustn't weary yourself too much."
Uwain rose and said, "Let me carry you, father." He stooped and lifted the sick man as if he were a child. Morgaine, following, turned back before leaving the dining hall to say, "See to all things here, Maeline. I will bandage Uwain's cheek before I go to rest."
Soon, Uriens was tucked into bed in his own chamber, Uwain standing beside him, while Morgaine went to the kitchens to brew a poultice for his cheek.
She had to prod the cook awake, and set him to heating more water over the kitchen fire. She should have a brazier and a cauldron in her own rooms if she was going to do this kind of work. Why had she never thought of it before? She went up and sat Uwain down so that she could poultice his cheek with the hot cloths wrung in steaming herb brew, and the young man sighed with relief as the poultice began to draw out the soreness from the festered wound.
"Oh, but that's good, mother. That girl at Arthur's court wouldn't know how to do this.
When I marry her, mother, will you teach her some of your craft?
Her name is Shanna, and she's from Cornwall. She was one of Queen Isotta's ladies.
How is it that Marcus calls himself King in Cornwall, mother? I thought Tintagel belonged to you."
"So it does, my son, from Igraine and Duke Gaulois. I knew not that Marcus thought to reign there," Morgaine said.
"Does Marcus dare to claim Tintagel as his own?"
"No. For the last I heard, he had no champion there," Uwain said. "Sir Drustan has gone into exile in Brittany."
"Why? Was he one of the Emperor Lucius's men?" asked Morgaine. This talk of the court was a breath of life in the deadness of this isolated place. Uwain shook his head.
"No. There was talk that he and Queen Isotta had been over-fond of each other," he said. "One can hardly blame the poor lady. Cornwall is the end of the world, and Duke Marcus is old and peevish, and his chamberlains say he is impotent too. Hard life for the poor lady, while Drustan is handsome and a harper, and the lady fond of music."
"Have you no gossip of court save of wickedness and other men's wives?"
demanded Uriens, scowling, and Uwain laughed.
"Well, I told the Lady Shanna that her father might send a messenger to you, and I hope, dear father, that when he comes you will not refuse him.
Shanna is not rich, but I have no great need of a dowry. I won goods enough in Brittany. I shall show you some of my plunder,"
and I have gifts for my mother, too.
He raised his hand to stroke Morgaine's cheek as she bent over him, changing the poultice for a fresh one.
Well, I know you are not such a woman as that Lady Isotta, to turn your back on my good old father and play the harlot.
Her cheeks stung. She bent over the kettle of steaming herbs, wrinkling her nose at the bitter scent. Owain thought her the best of women, and his trust was sweet to her. Yet there was the bitterness of knowing it unmerited. At least I have never made Urien's look a fool, nor yet flaunted any other lovers in his face.
But you should go to Cornwall when my father is well enough to travel, Owain said seriously, flinching a little as the heat of the poultice touched a new spot on his festered cheek. There should be a clear understanding, Mother, that Marcus cannot lay claim to what is yours. You haven't shown your face in Tintagel for so long that the common people may forget they have a queen. I'm sure it will not come to that, said Uriens. But if I'm well again this summer, I will ask Arthur, when I ride to Pentecost, about this matter of Morgaine's lands.
And if Owain marries into Cornwall, said Morgaine, he shall keep Tintagel for me. Would you like to be my castellan, Owain?
I would like nothing better, said Owain, except perhaps to sleep tonight without 40 separate toothaches in my jaw.
Drink this, said Morgaine, pouring one of her medicines from a small flask into his wine, and I can promise you sleep.
I would sleep without it, I think, madam. I'm so glad to be in my own home and my own bed under my mother's care.
Owain bent and embraced his father, and kissed Morgaine's hand.
But I will take your medicines willingly.
He swallowed the medicined wine, and beckoned to one of Urien's men-at-arms to light him to his own room.
Accolon came, and embraced his father, and said, I too am for my bed. Lady, are there pillows there? Or is the room empty and bare? I haven't been home in so long. I expect to find pigeons roosting in that old room where I used to sleep, and Father Ian tried to beat Latin into my head through the seat of my breeches.
I told Maeline to be sure you had everything you needed, said Morgaine, but I will come and see.
Will you need me again this night, my lord? She asked, turning to Urien's. Or shall I too go to my rest?
Only a soft snore answered her, and his man, Hugh, settling the old man on the pillows, answered,
Go, Lady Morgaine. If he wakes in the night, I'll look after him.
As they went out, Accolon asked,
What ails my father?
He had the lung fever this winter, said Morgaine, and he is not young.
And you have had all the weight of caring for him,
Accolon said.
Poor Morgaine.
And he touched her hand. She bit her lip at his tender voice. Something hard and cold inside her, frozen there since the winter, was melting, and she thought she would dissolve into weeping. She bent her head and didn't look at him.
And you, Morgaine, not a word or a look for me?
He reached out and touched her, and she said between clenched teeth,
Wait.
She called a servant to fetch fresh bolsters, a blanket or two from the store. Had I known you were coming, I would have had the best linens and blankets and fresh bedstraw. He said in a whisper,
It's not fresh straw I want in my bed.
But she refused to turn her face to him while the serving women were making the bed up, bringing hot water and light, and hanging up his armour and outer garments. When they were all away for a moment, he whispered,
Later, may I come to your room, Morgaine?
She shook her head and whispered back, I will come to you. I can have some excuse for being out of my chamber in the middle of the night, but since your father has been ill, often they come to fetch me. You mustn't be found there. And she gave him a quick, silent pressure of her fingers. It was as if his hand burned her. Then she went with the chamberlain on the last rounds of the castle to make sure that all was locked and secure.
"God give you a good night, lady," he said, bowing, and went away.
She tiptoed through the hall where the men-at-arms slept, moving on noiseless feet, along the stairs, past the room where Avaloch slept with Maylene and the younger children, the room where young Con had slept with his tutor and his foster brothers, before the poor lad had succumbed to the lung fever. In the farther wing were Urien's own chamber. One she now kept for herself, another room, usually allotted to guests of importance, and at the far end, the room where she had left Accolon. She stole toward his room, her mouth dry, hoping he had had the sense to keep his door ajar. The walls were old and thick, and there would be no way he could hear her at his door. She looked into her own room, went in, swiftly, and disarranged the bedclothing. Her own waiting woman, Ruach, was old and deaf, and in the winter past Morgaine had cursed her for her deafness and stupidity. But now that would serve her. Even so, she mustn't wake in the morning and find Morgaine's bed untouched. Even old Ruach knew that King Urien's wasn't well enough to share his bed with the Queen. How often have I told myself I am not ashamed of what I do? Yet she mustn't bring scandal on her name, or she could accomplish nothing here. But she hated the need for secrecy and furtiveness. He had left the door ajar. She slipped inside, her heart pounding, and pushed the door shut, felt herself seized in a hungry embrace that waked her body into fierce life. His mouth closed on hers as if he had starved for this as much as she. It seemed as if the whole winter's desolation and pain fell away, and that she was like melting ice, that she would flood and overflow. She pressed her body to Accolon's and fought to keep from crying. All her resolve that Accolon was no more to her than priest of the goddess, that she would not allow any personal tie between them, had gone for nothing in the face of this wild hunger in her. She had felt so much scorn for Guinevere, bringing the court to scandal and her king into contempt, because he could not keep his wife in order. But now, in Accolon's arms, all her resolve melted. She sank down in his embrace and let him carry her to his bed. Chapter 2 The night was far advanced when Morgaine slipped away from Accolon's side. He lay heavily asleep. She ran her fingers over his hair, kissed him softly, and stole from the room. She hadn't slept. She had feared to sleep too long and be surprised there by day. It was more than an hour before sunrise. Morgaine rubbed her burning eyes. Somewhere outside a dog barked. A child wailed and was hushed. Birds chirped in the garden. Morgaine thought, looking out through a narrow slit in the stone wall, "In another moon it will be full daylight at this hour." She leaned for a moment against the wall, overcome by memories of the night past. "I never knew," she thought. "I have never known what it was to be only a woman. I have borne a child, and I have been married for 14 years, and I have had lovers. But I knew nothing. Nothing." She felt a sudden rough hand on her arm. Avaloch's hoarse voice said, "What are you doing, sneaking around the house at this hour, girl?" He had evidently mistaken her for one of the servant women. Some of them were small and dark with the blood of the old ones. "Let me go, Avaloch," she said, looking at the dimly seen face of her older stepson. He was heavy and soft, his jowls blurred with fat, his eyes small and set close. Accolon and Uwain were handsome men, and one could see that once Urien's had been good-looking in his own way, but not Avaloch. "Well, my lady mother," he said, stepping back and giving her an exaggerated bow. "I repeat, what were you doing at this hour?" His hand remained on her arm. She picked it off as if it were a crawling bug. "Must I account for my movements to you? It is my house, and I move in it as I will. And that is my only answer." "He dislikes me," she thought, almost as much as I dislike him.
"Don't play games with me, madam," said Avaloch. "Do you think I do not know in whose arms you spent the night?"
She said contemptuously, "Now is it you who play with sorcery and the sight?" His voice dropped and took on a cozening sound.
"Of course it must be dull for you, wed to a man old enough to be your father. But I wouldn't hurt my father's feelings by telling him where his wife spends her nights, provided..."
He put his arm round her, and by main force drew her close to him. He bent his head and nibbled on her neck, his unshaven cheek scratching her.
"Provided you come and spend some of them with me."
She pulled away from him and tried to make her voice jocular.
"Come now, Avaloch. Why should you pursue your old stepmother when the spring maiden is yours, and all the pretty young maidens in the village?" "But I've always looked on you as a beautiful woman," he said,
and his hand stole out to caress her shoulder, sliding under the half-fastened front of her robe. She pulled away again, and his face twisted into a snarl.
"Why play the modest maiden with me? Was it Accolon, or Uwain, or both at once?"
She stared at him. "Uwain is my son. I am the only mother he can remember."
"Am I to think that would stop you, Lady Morgaine? It was common talk at Arthur's court that you were Lancelot's paramour, and tried to lure him from the queen, and that you shared the Merlin's bed, that you hadn't stopped at making unlawful love to your own brother. And that was why the king sent you from court, that you might tempt him no more from Christian ways. Why should you stop at your stepson? Does Uriens know what kind of incestuous harlot he took for his wife, madam?"
"Uriens knows everything about me that he has any need to know," said Morgaine, surprised that her voice was so steady. "As for the Merlin, we were then both unwed, and neither of us cares anything for the laws of a Christian court. Your father knew and absolved me of that. None but he has any right to complain of my conduct since then. And when he does so, I will answer to him, as I need not answer to you, Sir Avaloch. And now I will go to my own room, and I bid you do the same."
"So you throw the pagan laws of Avalon at me,"
Avaloch said, his voice a sneering growl.
"Harlot, how dare you claim you are so good?"
He grabbed her, his mouth crushed hers. Morgaine stabbed her stiffened fingers into his belly. He grunted and let her go with a curse. She said angrily, "I claim nothing. I need not answer to you for my conduct. And if you speak to Uriens, I will tell him that you laid hands on me in a fashion unseemly for your father's wife, and we will see whom he will believe." Avaloch snarled.
"Let me tell you, lady, you may cozen my father as you will, but he is old, and on the day I am made king in this land, be sure there will be no more grace extended to those who have lived on, because my father cannot forget that once he wore the serpents."
"Oh, rare," said Morgaine scornfully. "First you make advances to your father's wife, and then you boast of how good a Christian you will be when your father's land is yours."
"You first bewitched me, harlot."
Morgaine couldn't keep back her laughter. "Bewitch you? And why? Avaloch, if all men save you vanished from the earth, I would sooner share my bed with one of the puppies. Your father may be old enough to be my grandsire, but I would sooner lie with him than you. Do you think I am jealous of Maylene, when every time you go down to the village at harvest or spring ploughing festival, she sings? If I made such an enchantment, it wouldn't be to enjoy your manhood, but to wither it. Now, get your hands off me, and go back to whoever will have you, for if you touch me again with one fingertip, I swear I will blast your manhood." He believed she could do it. That was clear from the way he shrank from her. But Father Ian would hear of this, And then he would question her, and he would question Accolon, and he would question the servants. And then he would be at Urien's again to cut down the sacred grove and put down the old worship. Avaloch wouldn't stop until he had set this whole court by the ears. I hate Avaloch. Morgaine was surprised that her rage was physical, a scalding pain beneath her breastbone, a shaking through her whole body. Once I was proud. A priestess of Avalon doesn't lie. And now there is something about which I must avoid the truth. Even Urien's would see me as a treacherous wife, creeping in secret to Accolon's bed for her own lusts. She was weeping with rage, feeling Avaloch's hot hands again on her arm and her breast. Now, soon or late, she would be accused. And even if Urien's trusted her, she would be watched. Oh, I was happy for the first time in many years, and now it is all spoilt. Well, the sun was rising. Soon the housefolk would be waking, and she must make arrangements for the work of the day. Had he been only guessing? Urien's must keep his bed. Certainly Avaloch wouldn't disturb his father this day. She must brew some more of the herb medicine for Uwain's face wound, and the roots of one of his broken teeth must be dug out too. Uwain loved her. Surely he wouldn't listen to any accusation Avaloch might make. And at that, she felt the flooding, surging fury again, remembering Avaloch's words. Was it Accolon or Uwain, or both at once? I am as much Uwain's mother as if I had borne him. What kind of woman does he think me? But was that rumour indeed in Arthur's court that she had committed incest with Arthur himself? How then, in the face of that, can I bring Arthur to acknowledge Gwydion his son? Galahad is Arthur's heir, but my son must be acknowledged, and the royal line of Avalon. But there must be no further scandal about me, certainly not any hint that I have committed incest with my stepson. And she wondered a little at herself. She had flown into a desperate rage when she knew she was to bear Arthur's son, and now it seemed trivial to her. After all, she and Arthur hadn't even known themselves brother and sister. But Uwain, no blood kin to her, was far more her son than Gwydion. She had mothered Uwain. Well, there was nothing to be done about it now. Morgaine went to the kitchen and heard the cook complain that all the bacon was gone, and the storerooms were near enough empty to make it hard to feed all these homecomers. "Well, we must send Avaloch to hunt today," said Morgaine, and stopped Maeline on the stairs as she carried up her husband's morning drink of hot wine. Maeline said, "I saw you talking with Avaloch. What did he have to say to you?" She frowned a little, and Morgaine, reading her thoughts, as it was easy to do with a woman as stupid as Maeline, realized that her daughter-in-law feared and resented her, thought it unfair that Morgaine should still be slim-bodied and hard, when she, Maeline, was heavy and worn with childbearing, that Morgaine should have glossy, dark hair, when Maeline herself, busied with babies, never had time to comb and plait her own, and make it shine. Morgaine said truthfully, but also with a wish to spare her daughter-in-law's feelings, "We spoke of Accolon and of Uwain, but the storerooms are nearly empty, and Avaloch must go hunting for boar." And then what she must do flashed full-blown into her head, and for a moment she stood frozen, hearing Ninian say, in mind and memory, "Accolon must succeed his father," and her own voice replying. Maeline was staring at her, waiting for her to finish what she was saying, and Morgaine quickly collected herself. "Tell him that he must go out after boar. Today, if he can, tomorrow at the latest, or we shall be eating the last of the flour too soon." "Certainly I will tell him, mother," said Maeline. "He will be glad to have an excuse to be away." And through Maeline's complaining voice, Morgaine knew that the younger woman was relieved that it had been nothing worse. Poor woman, married to that pig. She remembered, troubled, exactly what Avaloch had said. On the day I am made king in this land, there will be no more grace extended to those who have lived on, because my father cannot forget that once he wore the serpents. This, then, was her task, to make certain that Accolon should succeed his father. If I had half an hour to tell Accolon all, he would go with Avaloch hunting, and I doubt not that would solve all. And she thought, with cold calculation, shall I keep my hands clean of this, and leave it to Accolon? Uriens was old, but he might live another year, or another 5 years. Now that Avaloch knew all, he would work with Father Ian to undermine any influence Accolon and Morgaine might have, and all that she had done would be undone again. If Accolon wants this kingdom, perhaps it is he who should make certain of it. If Avaloch dies of poison, it is I who will die for a sorceress. Yet if she left it to Accolon, then would it be all too much like that old ballad, the one which began, two brothers went a-hunting. Shall I tell Accolon and let him act in his rage? Troubled, still not certain what she would do, she went up to find Accolon in his father's room, and as she came in she heard him say, today Avaloch goes to hunt boar. The storeroom is near to empty. And I will ride with him. It is all too long since I have hunted in my own hills. No, Morgaine said sharply. Stay with your father today. He will need you. And Avaloch has all his huntsmen to help him. She thought, somehow I must tell him what I mean to do. And then she stopped herself. If he knew what she planned, though she wasn't yet sure herself what form her necessity would take, he would never accede to it, except perhaps in his first anger at hearing what Avaloch had said to her. And if he did, she thought, though I thought I knew him better than that, still my own hunger for his body might have deceived me, and he may be less honourable than I think him. If he were such a one as would consent to be party to this, then he would be kinslayer, and under that curse, and not such a one as I could trust for what lies before us. Avaloch is kin to me by marriage alone. There is no blood tie to dishonour. Only if I had borne Uriens a son would there be blood guilt on me. Now she was glad she had given Uriens no son. Accolon said, let Uwain stay with father. If his cheek wound is being poulticed still, it is he that should stay indoors and keep to the fireside. How can I make him understand? His hands must be clean. He must be here when the news comes. What can I say to him to make him understand that this is important? Perhaps the most important thing I shall ever ask of him. Urgency and the impossibility of voicing her inner thoughts made her voice sharp. Will you do as I ask you without argument, Accolon? If I am to tend Uwain's wound too, I shall have no leisure to tend your father as well, and he has been left to serving folk all too often of late. And your father, if the goddess is with me, shall have more need of you at his side than ever before this day is ended. She slurred her words, hoping Uriens wouldn't understand what she was saying. As your mother, I ask it, she said. But what she was saying to Accolon with all the force of her thoughts was, from the mother I command it. Obey me, she said. And, turning a little away from Uriens so that Accolon alone could see, she touched the faded blue crescent on her forehead. Accolon looked at her, puzzled, questioning, but she turned away, shaking her head slightly, hoping that at least he would understand why she couldn't speak more freely. He said, frowning, certainly, if you wish it so much. It is no hardship to stay with my father. Morgaine saw Avaloc ride out at mid-morning with 4 huntsmen, and while Maeline was in the lower hall, she slipped into their bedchamber, searching through the untidy room and through the discarded baby clothes and still unwashed napkins of the youngest. At last she found a small bronze arm ring she had seen Avaloc wear. There were some gold things, too, in Maeline's chest, but she didn't dare to take anything of value which might be missed when Maeline's servant came to sort out the room. As it was, the serving woman found her there and asked, "What did you want, lady?" Morgaine feigned anger. "I will not live in a house that is kept like a pig's byre. Look at all these unwashed napkins. They stink of baby shit. Take them down now and give them to the washwoman, and then sweep and air this room. Must I put on a clout and do all the sweeping myself?" "No, madam," said the servant, cringing, and took the fouled cloths that Morgaine heaped in her arms. Morgaine tucked the bronze ring inside her bodice and went down to have the cook heat water for Uwain's wound. That must be done first. And somehow she must order things in this house so that she would be idle and alone this afternoon. She sent for the best surgeon to bring his tools, and made Uwain sit down and open his mouth so that she could help to find the broken root of his tooth. He endured the probing and pulling stoically, though the tooth broke off in his jaw and again had to be dug for. Fortunately, it was numb and swollen. And finally, when all the tooth was out, she dropped some of her strongest numbing medicine into the wound and poulticed the sore, swollen cheek again. Finally, it was done, and Uwain sent to bed with a strong dram of liquor inside him. He protested, arguing that he had ridden and even fought when he was in worse case than this. But she firmly ordered him to go to his bed and let her medicines take their full effect. So Wayne, too, was safely out of the way, and beyond suspicion. And since she had sent the servants to do washing, there were none of these either, so that Maeline began to complain, "If we are to have new gowns for Pentecost, and if Avaloc is to have his cloak finished..." "You do not like to spin, mother, but I must weave at Avaloch's cloak. And all the women are heating kettles of water for the washing and getting out their beating paddles." "Oh, dear, I had forgotten that," said Morgaine. "Well, there is no help for it. I must spin, then. Unless you would have me do the weaving." Better, she thought, even than the arm ring, a cloak made to his measure by his wife. "Would you do that, then, mother? But you have the king's new cloak set up on the other loom." "Uriens doesn't need it so much as Avaloc," Morgaine said. "I will weave at Avaloch's cloak." "And when I am done," she thought, a shudder running through her heart, "he will never need a cloak any more."
"Then I will spin," said Maeline, "and I will be grateful to you, mother. You weave better than I."
She came and pressed her cheek to her mother-in-law's.
"You are always kind to me, Lady Morgaine."
"But you do not know what I shall be weaving today, child." Maeline sat down and picked up the distaff. She paused for a moment, pressing her hands to her back.
"Are you not well, daughter-in-law?"
Maeline said, "It is nothing. My courses are 4 days late. I'm afraid I've gotten with child again, and I had hoped I could nurse the baby another year." She sighed. "Avaloc has women enough in the village, but I think he never loses hope I will give him another son to take Conn's place. He doesn't care anything for the girls. He didn't even weep when Maeva died last year, just before I was brought to bed with the baby. And when she was another girl, he was really angry with me, Morgaine.
If you truly know any charms, could you give me a charm so that I would bear a son next time I'm brought to bed?"
Morgaine smiled, putting the shuttle to the threads. She said, "Father Ian will not like it if you ask me for charms. He would tell you to pray to the Virgin Mother for a son."
"Well, her son was a miracle, "'And I am beginning to think that if I ever have another son, "'it would be another miracle,' said Maylene. "'But perhaps it is only this dismal chilly weather.' "'I will make you some tea for that,' said Morgaine. "'If you are truly with child, I swear it will not disturb you. "'But if it is only delay from a chill, it will bring on your courses.' "'Is this one of your magical spells from Avalon, mother?' "'Morgaine shook her head. "'It's herb lore no more,' she said, "'and went to the kitchen and made up the brew over the fire. "'She brought it to Maylene and said, "'Drink it as hot as you can, and wrap up in your shawl while you spin. "'Try to keep warm.' "'Maylene drank up the brew, emptying the little pottery cup, "'and grimaced at the taste. "'Oh!' Foul. Morgaine said, smiling, I should have put honey in it, as I do with the brews I make for the children when they have fever. Maylene sighed, taking up the spindle and distaff again. She said, Gwyneth is old enough to spin. I could spin when I was 5 years old. So could I, said Morgaine. But I beg you, defer the lesson another day, for if I'm to weave in here, I do not want noise and confusion. Well, then, I will tell the nurse to keep all the children out in the gallery, said Maylene. And Morgaine dismissed her from her mind, beginning to run the shuttle slowly through the cloth and making sure of the pattern. It was a pattern of green and brown checkered cloth, not very demanding for a good weaver. So long as she counted the threads automatically, she need not keep her mind on it very long. Spinning would have been better, but she had made her distaste for spinning so well known that if she volunteered to spin this day, it would be remembered. The shuttle slid through the cloth, green, brown, picking up the other shuttle every tenth row, changing the colour. She had taught Maylene to dye this green colour, which she had learned in Avalon, green of the new leaves coming into the spring, brown of the earth, and of the fallen leaves where the boar rooted in the forest for acorns. Shuttle sliding through the cloth, the comb to tighten each row of threads, her hands moving automatically, in and out and across. Slide down the bar, pick up the shuttle from the other side. Would that Avalok's horse would slip and fall, and he would break his neck and save me from what I must do. She felt cold and shivered, and willed herself to ignore it, concentrating on the shuttle sliding in and out of the threads, in and out, letting images rise and go at will, seeing Accolon in Urien's chamber, playing with his father at draughts, Uwain asleep, tossing and turning with the pain in his cheek wound, even through his slumber. But now it would heal cleanly. Would that a wild boar would fight back and Avalok's huntsman be too slow to come to his aid. I said to Ninian that I would not kill. Never name that well from which you will not drink. An image rose in her mind of the holy well of Avalon, the water rising from the spring, flooding into the fountain. The shuttle flickered in and out, green and brown, like the sunlight falling through the green leaves onto the brown earth, where the spring tides rising within the forest ran with life, sap running in the brown wood. The shuttle flashing now, faster and faster, the world beginning to blur before her eyes. Goddess, where you run in the forest with the running life of the deer, all men are in your hands, and all the beasts. Years ago she had been the virgin huntress, blessing the horned one, and sending him forth to run with the deer and to conquer or die as the goddess might decree. He had come back to her. Now she was no longer that virgin, holding all the power of the huntress. As the mother, with all the power of fertility, she had woven spells to bring Lancelot to Elaine's bed. But motherhood, for her, had ended in the blood of Gwydion's birth. Now she sat here with her shuttle in her hand and wove death,
like the shadow of the old death crone. All men are in your hands to live or die, mother. The shuttle flickered, flashed in and out of her sight, green, brown, green like leaves and forest intertwined,